Oh, good morning. I'm Katie Vale, and I'm Director of Academic Technology here in Harvard for the FAS. So I lead a group of educational technologists who work with Harvard faculty in creating educational software. My own background is in both sort of computer science and cognitive science, and then also in education. My undergrad degrees are in computer science and cognitive science, and then when I was a junior in college, I took an educational software seminar and became really, really interested in this and ended up going to grad school in education and have spent the last 20 years or so working in educational software development for a variety of markets. So I've produced things for K-12, for college, for professional training for doctors, and I've done museum exhibits and all kinds of things. And so the reason I wanted to come and talk to you today is to talk about lessons I've learned over the years and to keep you from being, or you're making some of the same mistakes that I did, or keep you from making mistakes or going off on tangents that I often see people do when they're starting out with this in this field. So here's how you might think that educational software development works. So you've taken a CS class, you have this really great idea for a piece of software that you'd like to develop. So you go ahead and you write the code, and then you take the finished product and you hand it over to the faculty member or teacher of your choice, and then you basically say, okay, this is great, now they're going to use my software and I'm going to become famous and make lots of money. And unfortunately, it really doesn't work this way, but I see this repeated all the time. I see this often that faculty just don't know what to do with the thing that you've created, and they're not invested in it because they didn't work with you to create something. So if nothing else, the point I want to drive to you is that the education has to drive the software development. You can't start it as a technology problem and expect it to be sort of adopted in education. You have to be solving a particular educational problem in order for your software to work. So how educational software development really works is that, again, you first identify some kind of a problem. And I would also say that these steps are also the same as you would go through if you were designing just a regular course, not just a piece of software. So this is the foundations of what's called instructional design. And there's lots of research about this that you can go into, but I'm just going to give you the basics of the steps for right now. So as I said, first you're going to start with identifying a particular problem or a set of goals, or what are the things that you want to teach, or what's the issue that you find as a teacher, year after year the students have trouble getting a particular point. And then, again, instead of sort of diving into creating the course, what you want to actually do is then go to the very end and figure out, all right, I know what the goals are, then how am I going to assess whether the students have met those goals? Or how am I going to know whether this solved the educational problem that I've developed? So that might mean if you're designing a course that you're going to write the test. If it's going to be a piece of software, you're going to figure out what's the assessment criteria that's going to make me know that this piece of software actually did what it set out to do. Then when you have sort of the bookends there, that's when you then dive into creating the materials, figure out how you're going to teach things, or are you going to use role plays, simulations, and we'll get into that in just a moment. And what kind of media are you going to use? Are there going to be videos? Is it going to just be code? What's it going? How are you going to set this up sort of technically? Then you launch sort of the pilot of the software. You watch as it's being used in the course. And again, you do some assessments, talk to people who've used it, talk to the faculty, and then you make adjustments as necessary. Then the final step, which is crucial and is one that I see people skipping all the time, you have to document your code, both with user documentation and the internal documentation. Because if your piece of software is going to be successful, it absolutely is going to have to be ported in the future. And I'll tell you some more specifics about that. But you can't assume you're going to write this thing once and be able to forget about it. I've never seen a piece of educational software that's been able to exist longer than a year or two without needing to be updated or ported or so on. So how do we get started with this? How do we start writing these goals or sort of writing the specifications for the software? What you want to be able to start off with is the first question that's here. So after using this piece of software, what should students be able to do? And again, this is the same principle for instructional design for a course. After taking this course, what should students be able to do? And you want to actually sort of write this down and use sort of verbs that really will let you be will let you assess whether the goals have been reached. So you want to you want them to be able to list things, identify things, demonstrate their knowledge in some way. And it can be kind of tricky because often what a teacher will say is, I just want them to understand something better. And you really kind of have to tease out what they mean by that. Well, how will you know if they've understood something better? So one of the approaches to this is to say sort of, what should students remember after a few years after doing this? And this is actually an approach that we take here on campus with the general education courses. So that's one of the things we ask the faculty to think about is, what should students remember, 5 years after taking this particular class? And this is something that you should ask them to be thinking about when you're developing the software as well. What should they remember in a few years? So how will you know whether this piece of software actually made a difference? So, a couple examples of sort of goal writing or of being able to do the sort of the specs for your software. You want to be able to have sort of some sentences that look something like this, so that after using this application or this software, students will be able to, and so these would be some sort of good examples. You might have them be identify parts of a diagram or categorize things or make lists or demonstrate something. Some examples that really aren't so good are the sort of vague verbs that really are not action-oriented, that you don't want to say that they're going to be able to understand something better or they will know something. And again, this is really a hard one for a lot of teachers to grasp. And what you often will find out when you're doing the needs analysis is that you really have to have a kind of a dialogue with them to say, well, how will you know if they understood this novel? How will you know if they've appreciated, the art of the Renaissance or something like that? And so, it can be kind of hard, and you might have to push the teacher to really talk about what they mean. But this is also good for their course in general, because I think we've all taken courses where it's not been entirely clear what the entire point of the course was. It just seemed like a series of readings, and there weren't really stated goals for the class. So by kind of getting into this sort of good instructional design practice in your software, you can actually also influence the course as a whole. So after you have your goals for the class, you want to also keep in mind how this software is going to be used. Does the professor think about this as being something that's going to be used in class, or maybe sort of instead of a lecture? Is he going to have students do this outside of class and then come to class and do a group exercise? Is it going to be a graded assignment? Is it going to be, how is it really going to be integrated? Because one of the key things that we have learned sort of over the years is that if a piece of educational software is just an add-on to a course or it's an optional exercise, students won't do it. They won't spend the time on it. We see this all the time, at Harvard when people, put something on a website that's optional material. Students are busy, and if it's not something that they're going to be graded on, they're simply not going to do it. So, and I've been involved with enough projects like this over the years where, the faculty have something that they think is a good idea, but they're not really sure how to incorporate it, and they think, well, I'll just stick it on the website, or I'll just, if anybody wants to stay after class and do it, I will let them do that. And my advice to you is, if you find yourself in this position, run away, because it's not going to be worth your time. It takes a long time to make educational software, especially custom applications, and it's expensive. I mean, there'll be, sort of your salaries, and, if you're having to, buy machines for the students or something like that. So, there have been a lot of sort of bad examples over the years of people who've created something, it never really gets used, and then the other people who were sort of vying for that same budget money will grouse about that, and they'll say, oh, well, they didn't even use that. So what sort of your obligation is, if you're going to be developing educational software, is to do everything you can to prove its worth. And the best way to do that is to make sure at the start that this is something the teacher is really invested in and really wants to do. Okay. So some other things to think about. You have to think about what the students have. And like it or not, you're kind of bound to whatever the lowest common denominator is on their technology. So if you have an idea of something that's going to work in a K-12 school, you might want to sort of take a survey of what several different schools have in terms of technology. If you're designing something that's going to work at, say, you know, Phillips Andover, where they have all brand new equipment and they have a multimedia lab and things like that. You know, that might work very well there, but then you won't be able to repurpose it, say, at an inner city school where they, you know, have old PCs or something like that. So it's not always fun to have to design for the lowest common denominator, but if you want your project to be more than kind of a one-off for one particular class, it is something that you have to think about. You also have to look at sort of what else, what other kinds of infrastructure are there for the students. Do they have people who can train them? Is there somebody in the computer lab who can sort of hold their hand and walk them through this? Do you have to then write a training guide that goes with your software? Depending on how your project has been funded, you may have also some other concerns that you need to build in from the start. Often educational software gets built based on a grant that someone has applied for. It may be part of a faculty member's research grant where they have sort of an outreach component that they have to do. It might be a specific grant that you've received, say, from the National Science Foundation or something like that. And when there are grants, there are typically very particular stipulations that you have to follow, to, again, to prove sort of the worth of what you did. So you might be told that as part of this, you have to have a control group, that you have to have one section of students who don't use the software and one that does. This sounds that sort of, you know, that's obvious from sort of a scientific experiment, but it's actually can be really, really difficult to pull off, that you know, especially in public education. You know, people will get mad if their child is in the class that uses the that doesn't use the software when they see other people, you know, being. It fosters an idea that students are getting an unequal education, and sometimes it's just difficult to pull off in that you have to teach two versions of the same course, one with the software and one without, and some faculty will kind of balk at that. So you need to look really carefully if you are applying, you know, for a grant. You'll also have to, you might have to do lots of different types of research on the software. Quantitative research is sort of the numbers-based or statistical research, and you have to think about, well, how am I going to be able to provide grade data? Am I going to be able to assess the students in such a way that I'm actually going to be able to see whether they've done better, you know, after they've used the software? Something that might be new to you is the form of, is qualitative research. And qualitative research is more about sort of telling stories, or sort of more observational. So, but it takes longer to do in many cases than the quantitative research. You might have to do interviews with TFs and with students and with faculty, look for themes across that data, and figure out sort of what's the story behind how students use the software that you've created. So the research pieces can take a really long time. They are really useful in figuring out whether your software actually worked or not. But if you are going to be applying for grants to develop something with a faculty member or a teacher, you need to look really carefully at the outset of what's going to be asked of you, because you can't really go back and just sort of fit those in after the fact. So this is kind of the meat of sort of the instructional design, or the pedagogical part. Everyone know the word pedagogical, which refers to sort of teaching and learning. So what we know sort of from the research on educational technology is that sort of these are sort of the areas, or the models of teaching, or the models of learning, where we have found educational technology to be the most useful. And the number one, which is sort of is the main sort of finding from many different studies, is that students like it because it's motivational. It appeals to them. It's something that's different from just sitting in a class. They get to sort of be, you know, active in a way, even if the active is just sort of mousing around. But it's letting them experience something and not to sort of sit in a room and be talked to. There's sort of controversial there's controversy about whether this idea that students have different learning styles is really true or not, but I have seen sort of just anecdotally that students who see themselves more as sort of a visual learner or as an experiential learner tend to prefer to use educational software than, again, to sit in a room and be talked at. So that's been sort of the number one finding. So if nothing else, if you're having trouble motivating your students about a particular field, you might consider, you know, using some form of media for that. Now, these other sort of areas are probably the most common types of educational software that you'll find. So things like simulation or role play. And I would sort of lump games into this. And you might have, you know, growing up played sort of, you know, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, or, you know, the Oregon Trail, for if any people are that old. I don't think that they still use that in K-12 anymore. But or just the idea that you're going to simulate some kind of experience. Maybe it's a field trip that you can't afford to take everybody on or something like that. So that's one. Visualization is something that we use a great deal at Harvard. We actually even have a visualization lab in the Science Center for looking at, say, 3D versions of molecules or proteins or things like this. Collaboration tools are obviously a big deal and that's sort of an easier one to solve these days, sort of with the cloud or things like Google Apps. Thinking about designing custom, say, wikis or shared data sets or ways that students can collaborate either outside of class or with students at other schools. Probably the most common type of educational software that you may have seen sort of growing up are sort of these drill and practice exercises, things like flashcards or things that have you identify something on a map, just things that are really for extra practice. And faculty often sort of gravitate to this first off just because it's something that they don't necessarily want to spend class time doing. So that tends to be one of their first ideas of, how could this help me? Well, I don't want to sit there in class and watch people practice their brushstrokes for kanji. I'd like to have an application so that they can do that by themselves later on. Now, another area that we see a lot of at sort of at the college level is trying to use software for critical thinking skills. And this is an area where we see less of sort of the development of custom software tools, but more of an integration of existing tools, whether those are data sets from the library or using statistical analysis tools. And sort of the challenge here is trying to get tools that might be designed for a professional researcher and repurpose those so that, say, a freshman or sophomore or someone who's just starting out in a particular field can use the tools to do the analysis but not get bogged down by the math or by the tool, learning the tool itself. So this tends to be a lot of what people who work in educational technology at the university level sort of end up doing. And then finally, I also want to make sure that you think about this area that's called constructivism, or learning by doing. And sometimes the best way to learn something is to have the students try to build the thing themselves. And certainly this is probably what CS50 is about. So the best way for you to learn about software is to build software. So when you are thinking about projects for students to do, don't necessarily think that you have to provide all of the resources for them and then they just sort of click through it. Maybe there are ways that you can design an application so that the students can actually build something as well. Or maybe what they end up doing is they build a multimedia presentation or a movie or some sort of creative assignment, because that could be more useful to them than to, again, sit through and passively follow links that you've already just provided for them, because you already know the material and they're the ones who have to learn it. So any questions on this particular part, on the sort of the pedagogical models and methods? Okay. So that was sort of the rationale from the education point of view of, how do you want to think about, what type of project that you're going to make. These are the types of projects that I see people doing all the time, and really this is sort of the less useful way to go about it. So often we say, I was looking for an excuse to learn PHP or learn Ruby, so I thought I would just, make a set of French flashcards. That's good, but then you want to think of that as that was sort of a practice exercise for yourself. You didn't work with a faculty member. You didn't, really go through instructional design. So you sort of treat that as something you just did for you and don't try to then kind of force it into, an existing course. And again, as I've said this, but I can't really say it enough, when it's not fully integrated into the course and the faculty member is treating it as an add-on, they're not really into it, and particularly when it's, I would say, more sort of style than substance. When people were first learning about HTML, one of the things I was always seeing was that, people were making blinking text or flaming logos or just things that they could do because they could, and it was sort of fun to do. But if it really does not have an educational purpose, I would say, don't do it. Go for something that's really more on style and less about, being showy. If you need to do something that's showy, that's fine. And when you're learning to code and you want to build something just to, show that you can, use multiple colors or something like that. But when you're actually building the app that's going to be used in class, less is definitely more. Okay. So to sort of recap a little bit of what we've gone so far, the most important success factors, of for the longevity of your project or the usefulness of your project is, first of all, you have to find an engaged teacher who actually sees the value of the project. And so, to give you an example, one of the things that we have here at Harvard is something called the PIDIF program, or the Presidential Instructional Technology Fellowships. I'll talk a little bit more about what those are later, but we have a call for proposals each year for Harvard faculty to say, hey, we have resources available if you want to develop educational software, submit a proposal, and we'll talk to you about this. And what I think the faculty get a little bit surprised about is we don't just sort of take any proposal that they make. We actually have them come in, we interview them, and we really try to get a sense of, is this something they really want to do, or is this more of a, like, they shrug their shoulders and say, sure, I think there should be a website about French literature. Yeah. So when we hear someone sort of, you know, again, just sort of having this nonchalant, like, oh, sure, I think that would be a good idea, we can tell that they're not really serious, and we can tell that that project is kind of doomed to oblivion in a way, because they're not really engaged with it. They haven't really thought what they want out of it. And just because something is a good idea, and it doesn't mean it necessarily has to get done, you know, because it probably, you know, won't get done, and it will languish, and it will have ended up being sort of a waste of time and money. So again, that's in my doctoral research, I looked at sort of the most successful projects in educational technology that began in the 1980s, and that was sort of my number one finding, was that the ones that really had the most impact and were most successful were the ones where there was a faculty member, you know, along with the technologist, who was kind of willing to be the cheerleader for the project, was willing to, you know, keep finding funds to port it to new systems, and was going to, you know, do any evaluation that was needed for funding bodies, and that was, you know, sort of the main, you know, criteria of success. So I would lump in with that, you know, that the project has these explicit educational goals. You know what you're trying to do with this piece of software, and you're not trying to sort of, you know, glom it onto someone whose syllabus has already been created and who's been teaching the class the same way for years. You hopefully want the fact that you've built something for them means that they're going to be changing their syllabus, or they're going to be changing the way that they teach. Now, something that people also fail to consider when they want to develop educational software is, you know, much like the saying that, you know, a puppy is not just for Christmas, a piece of educational software is not just for sort of the year or the several months that you're working on the project. You need to, you know, if the project is going to be successful, it's going to be a multi-year commitment by you as the developer, and certainly by the faculty member who wants to use this thing. Because, you know, as I said, you're going to need to continue to find funding as you need to port it to new systems, or you might need to be expanding it or adding to, you know, if it's a database-based or database-backed project, you'll be adding and making changes all the time. So it's really not something that you build, you're done, you forget about it and move on. Good educational software is something that really has a much longer lifespan. Another really important success factor is the documentation of the code. And you need to make sure that you both have, again, a sort of a user guide for your software, but even more importantly, you need to document the code as you're going along. One of the things that I remember my sort of freshman computer science teacher telling me, that, you know, if you get a job in computer science, your first job after college is most likely going to be that someone's going to hand you a piece of undocumented code, and your job's going to be to make sense of it and figure out what it does and document it or port it or whatever. And I have to say, I mean, he was absolutely right. From my experience and everybody I know who's, you know, gone on to work at Microsoft or Google or whatever, that has typically been their first assignment, is to take over some spaghetti code from somebody that somebody else had wrote, and they've left and it's not documented and they need to figure it out. So, you know, if you want your project to have a long lifespan, and you really need to make sure that you are designing it so that it will outlive you or outlast you. Especially if you are a student and you are starting a project, you know, sort of while you're an undergrad or while you're a grad student, you know, one day you're going to graduate and you're going to most likely, you know, leave town and move on. And you need to make yourself kind of, you know, dispensable to the process. If you design something so that you're the only one who knows how it works, or you're the only one who's got the password to the system or something like that, that's actually harmful. And it's something I see people do all the time, is that they're very invested in their project and they really don't like the idea of somebody else taking it over. But you're actually harming the project by doing that. And what you need to do is, you know, make yourself able to sort of walk away, because you also might reach a point where, you know, you've been working on this thing for 3 years or something like that, or you've already ported it twice, and now you're going to go to grad school, you know, around the world, and you don't really want the faculty member to be contacting you all the time for making changes or adding things to it. So you need to kind of build in the fact that one day it's likely that you will not be associated, you know, with this piece of software. And what I have learned sort of from my research for custom educational software, and I'm not talking about sort of the things that might get published, you know, by Pearson or something like that, but sort of the custom type things that you would do for a particular teacher or course, the average lifespan of these is really less than 4 years. And that might be because, you know, a student initiated the project. It might be because the faculty member changes their course or changes their syllabus, you know, that often. But it's not long. I mean, it's typically you know, not something that you're going to see being used for, you know, 10 years at a stretch. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the actual technology. And when you're a computer science scientist, or, you know, any kind of sort of engineer, really, you always want to build things, and that's always sort of your first thought is, how can I write something? How can I write some code that's going to solve this? How can I build something? And what I'm asking you to do is to try to kind of resist that urge, at least at the outset of the project, and really step back and think, you know, is software the right way to solve this problem? Because sometimes it's not necessarily a piece of interactive software. It could be you might want to make a video. So for example, I worked on a project where a faculty member wanted to make some educational software that would teach people how to use tools in a machine lab, or that would sort of refresh their memory of how to use the tools in the machine lab. And when we sort of discussed this a little bit more, what we came to the conclusion was that, you know, it would take a long time to kind of write something that's going to simulate sort of how a lathe works or something like that. But maybe we should just video it so students are actually seeing the real, you know, moving parts and know exactly where not to put their fingers and things like that. And came to the conclusion, like, yes, you know what, let's just do a series of videos about this instead. You also, I mean, you can think of the analogy of sort of textbooks. I mean, you've all taken courses where there are, you know, three or more different texts for the same class, and the teacher wants you to have one chapter of one and three chapters of the next one, and then maybe just, you know, half a chapter of the third. And, you know, faculty like to have sort of some kind of a custom textbook, and most people would, you know, try to almost write their own text, you know, through their course pack or something like that. And it's possible that maybe just some, you know, some custom essays or some custom, you know, texts would achieve the same purpose, you know, as writing a piece of software. And again, I want to make sure you are thinking about the idea that it doesn't have to be you writing the thing for the students to click through. Students really do learn, you know, very well from using the constructivist method or the learning by doing. So maybe you can create some kind of a framework that becomes an assignment where the students are the one who put together the multimedia assignments or whatever. And again, often the best choice is not to dive into writing code yourself, but it often can be repurposing existing applications. And again, at the college level in particular, we do this all of the time, so that, you know, you don't necessarily have to write your own mapping exercise. You can use, you know, Google Maps along with a series of, you know, a well thought out exercise of what exactly you want the students to do with Google Maps. Or, you know, then if you want to start getting fancy, Google has all these APIs where you can do, you know, so you can sort of customize that for a particular location, but you don't have to sort of, again, start from scratch. Or there might be things that you can do just in something simple like Excel. You know, I know a faculty member at MIT who uses Excel, or and only Excel, to teach statistical analysis, because all of those tools are already built into the application, and he figures, you know, why build something from scratch that's going to teach them this when, hopefully, you know, in their lives and business, they're going to be using Excel anyway, so they may as well know all the features of that software. And whatever you do, don't try to lead with the technology. And for whatever reason, we see this a lot in the educational technology world, that someone focuses on an application and then tries to, again, fit it into the curriculum. So whether that's, you know, hey, you know, maybe we can use gold farming in World of Warcraft to teach about the principles of economics. So, and that's really kind of backward. I mean, it might be that you would be able to repurpose World of Warcraft for teaching economics, but you need to figure out what are the actual issues, what are the things that you're trying to teach, and then figure out whether that's a platform that's actually going to work for you, or are students going to get distracted by, you know, smiting each other and just playing the game and not really think about the economics lesson that you were trying to teach them. So the thing about technology and educational software and why I really didn't make this kind of a hands-on, you know, sort of techie class is that the only thing that you can count on is that your platforms are always going to change. And you will likely have to port the software that you create, and you will, and likely have to port it, you know, sort of several times. So just to give you a little background of, like, the first project that I ever created was for a lunar geology. It was looking at the Apollo missions and looking at the what the geologic findings were from the astronauts on the Apollo missions. So, and this was in the late 1980s, and I was using a platform called Guide on the Macintosh to do this. And so we had that for a while, and then that company was sort of going out of business and had to figure out what I could port it to. So we moved it to this was again pre-web, hypertext platform called Intermedia that was developed at Brown, which is where I went to school. And it ran over LANs, but it was only available in one classroom on campus. So we ported it to Intermedia, we redid all the links, we optimized all the graphics and things like that. And then HyperCard came out, if anyone have ever heard of that, on the Mac. And the faculty member I was working with was saying, well, this would be great then if we put it in a HyperCard stack, then students aren't limited to just that one classroom and we could distribute it to other schools. And so then we spent about a year porting everything over to HyperCard and making everything fit on a little, you know, Mac SE screen and things like that. And then the faculty member I was working with showed it to some of his colleagues at NASA, who are the people who actually were funding this work. And they decided that they would like to turn it into a museum installation at the Air and Space Museum. So then I had to use sort of their custom museum system at Air and Space, and we put it into a sort of a static exhibit at the Air and Space Museum. And then by that time, I graduated and gone to grad school, and to be honest, I was kind of sick of working on this project. And so we sort of had to turn the source code over to the Air and Space Museum sort of, and to NASA, and then that was it. And then eventually HyperCard wasn't available anymore. The faculty member had moved on to teaching about Mars instead of the moon. And it just sort of slowly went into oblivion. And that's something that you really do need to accept when you develop educational software, and probably any software for that matter, is that someday your code is going to be retired. And it might have been really cutting edge and awesome when you made it, but after a while, people are likely not going to need it anymore, and that sort of needs to be okay with you. And just to give you an idea of, over the years that I've been working in educational software, we've gone through all of these different platforms, authoring languages, programming languages, database backends, all kinds of things, and there's always going to be something new. A couple of years ago, there was lots of hype about, the Second Life virtual environment, and everyone's moving into Second Life, and so we spent a lot of time making a mock-up of Harvard Yard in Second Life for an archaeology course. And now everybody is kind of fleeing away from Second Life, and now we have to figure out, well, how do we get all that stuff out of there? How do we get the 3D models, of the old Indian college, Harvard, into something else where it's going to stay? So you need to sort of choose your platforms wisely, but build the project in such a way that you can get your things out if you need to. And again, I'll echo Andy Van Dam, my old computer science professor. The best thing to do is always use what he called civilized coding practices. Document your code, make it so anybody else could pick this up and run with it. If you no longer want to work on it or you're not available to work on it, you need to be able to code so that you're part of a team and not just a standalone project that only you know the answer to. And again, I'd say these things do have a lifespan, and you have to kind of accept that in a way, particularly if it's a custom piece of software. I mean, I do work with some students who work on projects with faculty, and even though they're now in grad school at Stanford or something, they're still communicating with their old professor here and working on things. But what my group does as part of the FAS IT organization is we end up being the ones to kind of adopt some of this orphan code and try to figure it out and look through undocumented code and make it run and port it. And you know, we're happy to do that for Harvard, but not every place has that. And certainly K-12 schools do not have that at all. So the more you can make your code standardized and able to be understood by another competent programmer, the better off everybody will be. Another thing to think about when you're developing, as I said, well, one, I asked you to think about whether something actually has to be software. Can it be video? Can it be something else? But second, I want to make sure that you are aware that there actually are existing international repositories for educational software that are open source. And I'm a big believer in open source. Before I was at Harvard, I worked at MIT in part on the Open Courseware initiative. So I really like the idea of making educational resources available for free whenever possible. And there are a couple of different repositories where you can actually look before you build to see, gee, did somebody else already have this idea and do this? And if it's something that you think is fairly common, again, like flashcards for Spanish verbs or something like that, if it's a common idea, chances are it probably already exists out there. So one of the things that you want to do is take a look at portfolios like the Merlot organization, and I'll just bring up that website to give you an idea of what that looks like. Ignore the scrolling text, which I personally don't really like to do. But so Merlot is it's the Multimedia Educational Resources for Learning and Online Teaching. And it's a place where you can submit software that you've created, and it also is a place for peer review so that other people can try using your software or looking at your code, and they will give it ratings. And so you can browse the collection by different topics. So I'll just select the humanities one. And you can search by keywords or by different material types. So if I'm interested in what kind of humanities simulations might there be, and go through these. And some of them have been peer-reviewed, and they'll have sort of star ratings. So if you wanted to, say, look at something like this, and it will tell you a bit more about it, like what was it written in. In this case, it was written in Java. It will tell you when it was first added. So it was added in 2001. But, good news, it seems like they're still working on this and adding to it. It was updated in 2009. Here's who you can contact if you want to use it or to actually go directly to the material. So I strongly recommend before you embark on a particular project, look through something like Merlot to see whether somebody has thought about it before or if there's something similar. Because people who work in this field are generally very eager to collaborate or tell you about their experiences. And so if you're thinking of doing something in the same way, it's worth just sending them a quick email or giving them a phone call to see sort of what they learned from the project and what they might recommend to somebody else. If you're going to be developing materials for use here in FAS, one of the things that my group has put together is just a little Drupal database of projects that we have been working on, so that if you're thinking of something that could be used for a class, check here in the Harvard database to see whether something's already been done. And we've organized these. There's a little tag cloud, but you can also look through what are things that have been done for biology or engineering or things like that, and search through to see what's already exists. And maybe if there's sort of a suite of, say, simulations or something, maybe what you'll want to do is add on or write something that we can add to the existing suite and that all faculty would be able to draw from. So, save yourself some time. And I know as a computer scientist, you want to solve problems and you like to build things, but sometimes somebody else has already had the idea and you can kind of stand on their shoulders and build something that, adds to that. So, if you are a Harvard student and you're still interested in this, I did want to make sure that you were aware that we have opportunities for you to really kind of get your hands dirty in the field of educational software that goes beyond CS50. As I mentioned earlier, there's this program here called the Presidential Instructional Technology Fellowships, and this is a series of grants that come through the Provost Office, and every year we hire between 20 and 30 students to work on educational technology projects sort of for the Harvard community. And we typically have an application process, and we try to match up students with faculty who have certain needs. So generally, if you've taken CS50, that's typically enough training, you know, for most of the projects that we do. But if you have specific skills in something like, you know, video production or animation, or you have a strong background, say, in biology or engineering or something like that, we may be able to match you with a professor, and we pay you and train you and supervise you in creating an educational technology project. And we also can go through more about the instructional design process. We teach you how to do assessment and all of that. So if this is something that you'd be interested in, you're welcome to contact me. And we usually start, you know, looking at hiring people for summer around February or March. And we're located, you know, on the fourth floor of the Science Center. But beyond this, if you're thinking of doing an educational project for your CS50 project, I'm really happy to, you know, sort of talk through the ideas with you or point you in directions of places to look for similar projects or whatever. So is that free? My email's up here, and you know, David will have it after this class. So feel free to get in touch, because again, this is a field I'm passionate about, and I like to share it with other people. And hopefully from my talk today, I will save you from making some of the mistakes that I've made or that I've seen often, you know, made by other people working on instructional projects. So I guess I'll end there and take other questions. And thanks for your attention. So the question is, for someone who's working on sort of is it bioengineering or biotech? Biochemistry projects, and how do you incorporate those into the curriculum without sort of overwhelming people, or how do you negotiate among sort of content experts and material that might be at a much higher level, I think, is than people may be used to? Is that a fair way of?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, also maybe a sub-question. Mm-hmm. The science tends to become obsolete every 5 years.
Right.
So, like, how do you deal with that kind of fast turnover? It's really expensive to make these kinds of modules.
Right. And that's where, and the other part of the question is that it's also the science changes rapidly, and so how do you kind of keep up with that? Is that it's expensive to create educational software, you know, as I've shown. So, I mean, absolutely you need to have good content people to work with, and I think this is something where you really do need a team of people. So not just sort of the educational technologist, but also the sort of a content specialist who may or may not also be the instructor for the class. Sometimes instructors are, you know, are very busy, and while they they want to work on a project, we find that they will might try to delegate to whether that's a, you know, a head TF or something like that. It's helpful to have several people who are kind of thinking about the problem. But I also have found that for something like biology, there are already commercial applications that do a lot of this, so that you don't need to sort of be doing this sort of from scratch, but it's more of a matter of repurposing an existing application. So whether that might be there are applications like Sirius or molecular simulations or Genius or things like that. And you might want to work on developing a lab that students go to in person, where you're walking them through how to actually use the commercial software to teach a specific module, rather than trying to write something from scratch. Because again, and also you might want to be doing this in a facility where students can view things in 3D. They may not have their own, say, 3D glasses for something on their own machine, but you might have a facility, you know, where they can do this, and that's something that we have here in the Science Center. So, afterwards, I can put you in touch with a person who does our sort of bio animations and simulations, you know, for Harvard education. But that's really what I would recommend, is that might be something that's too complex to try to do something very, very custom, and that might be where you'll get more mileage out of using the commercial software, because then also, after the students are done with this, they kind of have a head start in learning how to use the software. So if they're trying to get a job in the future at, you know, Genzyme or Biogen or something like that, that gives them a leg up of other people who are applying for the job because they already have some familiarity with using this type of software. Okay.
What are some important benchmarks, do you think, in developing educational software or really computer projects in general?
So can you say more about what you mean by benchmarks?
What milestones you think are important?
Sure. And you learn this as part of, the question was, what kind of benchmarks should you look at when you're developing educational software or even just any type of programming? I generally follow sort of that instructional design process that I laid out for you before. So start with the goals of the course or the goals of the application. Figure out what's either going to be the test or the assessment or how are you going to figure out whether it was successful. And then you start thinking about, sort of either the syllabus or the storyboard, the workflow, something like that. So, you can probably then, after you've done sort of the goals and the test, I would probably go next to something like a storyboard, even if it's just, handwritten or something like that, to figure out what's the flow going to be sort of through the application. Along with your storyboard, you can try to start sort of pseudocoding that of figuring out, okay, well, here's where I need to display certain things, or here's where a calculation happens. And then you would go forth to sort of pick your technology. Are you going to write this in Ruby? Is this going to be a PHP app? Am I going to do this, just using, HTML5, something like that? So notice sort of that the technology choice comes after you've kind of tried to block it out a bit. So you do have to think about the structure of the whole thing and then figure out what's going to be the appropriate technology. So then beyond that, we would just be following the rest of the instructional design. You'd make a version of it, pilot it, observe how it goes, and then tweak as needed. So is that answer your question? Okay. So the question is about things like sort of some international specifications of things like SCORM, and so on. And that's actually what we've seen a lot in the educational technology, and especially in higher ed over the last few years, is people are not spending as much time on small individual projects, but more time on things like standards like SCORM or particular APIs that people should follow. And I'm trying to think of how to answer this. These are all specifications that I think if you're going into this field that are things you need to be aware of what kind of metadata are you going to be providing. If you're making a database that is you're thinking of for both research and teaching, you need to be able to be tagging things so that it can be as multi-purpose in the future as you possibly can. There are a lot of open source initiatives right now for educational software. There's things like Sakai or Moodle for sort of not only sort of learning management systems, but also the development of specific educational applications. And what those rely on are these sort of open APIs, and that people will agree to use these same types of metadata schema so that their materials can be reused. There's also a really interesting project going on here at Harvard in the IQSS group that's called the Dataverse. And their idea is that people can submit their data collections from whatever type of research that they've been doing, but that they are able to mark them up or you add metadata to these so that other people might be able to replicate their work or use their data set in new research. Or, and the part that I'm sort of most excited about, is to be able to maybe use some of these other research collections in classroom settings, again, to teach students how professionals become researchers or how people collect data and how they, how scientists might repeat experiments. And that's sort of what the scientific method is all about. So does that answer your question? Okay. Well, constructivism, or the question is, more about the sort of constructivism and learning by doing, and so what does that look like in terms of educational software? Now, I guess the point here is that it doesn't necessarily have to be that they are doing things that are solely sort of on the computer. A constructivist project may have some pieces that are, that are software-based, but they might also involve going out and collecting objects or going into libraries and finding different pieces of data. So for an example, a constructivist project might be that you give all the students cameras if they don't happen to have a camera phone. And again, you can't always assume that students will have a camera phone, so you need to figure out first what their lowest common denominator of technology is. And you might say, we're studying, the architecture of Boston. So go out, give them a map and say, all right, take photos of architecture that is interesting to you for some reason. And then have everybody come back and upload those, say, to Flickr and tag them in some way. They can, geotag them. They can tag them of street names or just things that they're as interesting to them. And then have them try to start sort of cataloging them or categorize them of, what do you think, looks like, federal style architecture? Do you see any, columns? Are there any Ionic columns or things like that? And that might be sort of how you would do a constructivist exercise in something that would normally be a sort of a history of art course or history of architecture course, where you're really getting the students to use the technology sort of in peace, but the whole part of the education doesn't have to live within the box. It facilitates the education. Or you might give them assignments where they have to calculate how Christopher Columbus sailed across the Atlantic. So what are the things that Columbus would have had to know of things like stellar navigation or ocean currents or things like that? That these might be things that they have to look up at the library and bring in data. They might have to do calculations, use little applets online to do things like figure out how someone would tell their position in the ocean. There's a course right now at Harvard, why I bring this up, on called Primitive Navigation. And one of the things that professor is doing is he's made a series of little applets that help students figure out how you would tell, say, how tall a building is by figuring out, the knuckles in your hand of what is an inch, and if you're standing a certain distance away and you go like this, how tall is that tree or how tall is that building? Or if it takes you 250 steps to get from the John Harvard statue, to the entrance of the Science Center, what does that mean in terms of distance? And then how can you guesstimate your distance, walking other places? So, you can use the computer for what it's good at, it might be, calculation or simulation, but it doesn't have to be where all of the instruction takes place. So, yeah.
A final question. You described very nicely the technologies, but now there is another issue that are the devices.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think, or how are you using here at Harvard the mobility?
Sure. So the question is about sort of mobile devices. And again, I think that's what we are seeing right now is that mobile devices are really popular. People have, Androids or iPads or whatever, and you can get really tempted to develop, specifically for those. And again, that's where I'll say you have to know sort of what the audience is you're developing for. And again, that sort of lowest common denominator. It would be really cool to write iPhone apps, and everybody, is looking at, learning how to write iPhone apps, but if you're expecting your project is going to be used, at a particular school, and the students, don't have iPhones, or you find that they don't even have phones yet, or even on Harvard's campus, we see faculty who say, "Oh, I have this iPhone app that I wrote or I found, and I want everyone to use it." Students have all different types of phones, and for in large parts of our campus, the phone service is, shall we say, suboptimal, so you won't be able to actually, get these things. So the approach that we're trying to take right now is to at least to start by designing for the web and then think of, make sure that what you're designing for sort of for the web can also be used in a, for mobile devices, as well. For courses that really want to have a mobile component, so we have some courses where students are out in the field doing research, say in geology or archaeology. one of the things that we're trying to do is work with the computer store on providing either loaners or rental units, say for iPads. So I have a rental program, so students in a course don't have to buy an iPad, but they could rent it for the semester, so they could use that particular piece of software, and then they can give it back or they can purchase it at the end of the semester. So I think it's kind of like the equivalent is sort of as in the early days of web design, when people were designing, assuming everybody had a cable modem or they had a T1 internet connection, but you had all your poor dial-up users who were sort of constrained about what they could see. It's sort of like that now, in that we're designing for the web, but you want to make sure that what you're creating at least makes some kind of sense on a mobile device. But then focus on the mobile device if you know that, absolutely know for certain that your audience has them, they have the connectivity, or you have a way of getting the devices to them. Okay, well, I will stay around afterwards if people have more questions. And as I said, you're really welcome to contact me if you want to talk about a CS50 or other project. So thanks for your attention this morning.